Stereo Theater presents The Scales of Justice.
Move your asses, you guys. I got a real hit. Come on, move.
This is kind of public, John.
It's the owner's office. I know the guy. Nobody's going to come in. Nelson can lean against the door if it's bugging you.
It's your friendly neighborhood watchdog.
Yeah, you'll get your goodies, man. You get them. Now, come on, Kathy. Fix this stuff.
It's the third time tonight. No, what am I saying? It's the fourth. That's getting heavy.
Yeah, well, my bread paid for it, right?
You want me to stop being Mother Caution? Okay, I'll stop.
Yeah, now, shoot me first. Then Nelson.
It's your stuff.
Okay. Roll your sleeve up higher, John. Well, I can't do everything.
Yeah, all right.
You haven't been doing bad so far.
Jesus, Kathy, man, that's fantastic.
In the early morning hours of March 5th, 1982, in a back room of a small private club in Hollywood, California, three people were injecting themselves with drugs. Within 10 hours, one of the three would be dead of acute cocaine and heroin intoxication. He was John Belushi, the well-known comedian and movie actor. A year later, another member of the trio, Kathy Smith, would be accused of administering the injections that killed Belushi. Kathy Smith is a Canadian, and shortly after Belushi's death, before the state of California indicted her on a charge of murder, she returned to live in Toronto. The United States government, on behalf of the state of California, requested her extradition from Canada to stand trial on the charge. The proceedings under the Canadian Extradition Act lasted almost 2 years. They shaped the fate of Kathy Smith, and in a broader sense, they brought under unprecedented examination fundamental rights that Canadian citizens have been guaranteed by our Charter of Rights. My name is Edward Greenspan, and the story you are about to hear is reconstructed from transcripts and judgments in the District Court of the Judicial District of York, the Supreme Court of Ontario, and the Ontario Court of Appeal, and from the trial notes of Kathy Smith's counsel, my brother, Brian Greenspan. The Scales of Justice, a series recreating real events in Canadian crime, with commentary by the Toronto lawyer Edward L. Greenspan, QC. In this episode, you will hear Chappelle Jaffe as Kathy Smith and Saul Rubinek as her lawyer, Brian Greenspan, in the true story of The Extradition of Kathy Smith, written by Jack Batten and produced by George Jonas. Kathy Smith belonged to the first rock and roll generation. She was born in 1947 to an unwed mother and grew up as the adopted daughter of a cement salesman and his wife in Burlington, a peaceful suburban community west of Toronto. But Kathy's early life was far from stable. She became a rebel and a loner. And in her mid-teens, she found an outlet for the emotional turmoil she was experiencing in the music of her generation. Elvis Presley, Rick Nelson, and other singers and bands seemed to speak directly to her, as they did to many teenagers of the early 1960s. But in Kathy's case, the music and the lifestyle that went with it became the central focus of her own life when a friend introduced her to the drummer in a rock band that was playing at a club in nearby Hamilton. The drummer's name was Levon Helm, and the band was called Levon and the Hawks.
Drummers, you know, they're my favorite.
Well, now, Kathy, honey, that makes me feel real nice.
I guess it's because drumming is so physical. You can feel it when a drummer plays.
It's a lot of work drumming.
You know what, Levon? I like it the way you play fast and talk real slow.
Everybody talks real slow where I come from down in Arkansas.
Well, I've never been further than Toronto.
How old are you anyway, Kathy?
How old do you think I am? Well, go ahead, take a guess.
That dress with the slit up the back you got on there, all that real smart makeup, you could be most any age.
Maybe I am any age.
You're a very mature young lady, you know that?
Some people think so.
We got rooms at the motel down the way, the band and me. We're going to party after the last set. You like to come along? We got something to drink, something to smoke. You're real nice.
Well, yeah. I like to party anytime.
Tell me something else, Gaddy. You like to cuddle when you sleep?
Kathy Smith became a groupie. Only 16, she began to hang out with Levon and the Hawks. Levon and the Hawks eventually grew wealthy and famous under another name, The Band, one of the most critically praised rock groups of the day. As for Kathy, she was left with a poignant reminder of her first contact with rock music, a pregnancy. She gave birth to Levon Helm's daughter and put the child into adoption. But her fascination with the music world didn't fade. In the late 1960s, living in Toronto and working as a part-time waitress at the Riverboat, the city's leading folk club, she became the lover of another prominent musician, Gordon Lightfoot.
These were the best times, Gordy. Just the two of us.
Mm-hmm.
I like it best when we're alone here, way up high in the apartment, up over the whole city, over everything.
I like it too, Kathy.
At night like this, that's when it's most peaceful. Like there's nothing else in the world except you and me and all those lights out there.
Yeah, you know, if this song had come right, things would be perfect.
It'll come right. Your songs always do.
What's that your song?
I'm putting some beads on the shoulder of your new jacket. See, they sparkle in the lights. You'll look great when you're up there on the stage.
You know something, Kathy? You understand. I mean, some women are long for the ride and the money, but you understand music, and you understand the life.
Maybe that's how come things are working for us.
That, and the great times in bed.
It's weird. Sometimes I think about us. Red wine, young love, the snow outside and everything. And I think what our life is a Gordy Lightfoot song.
Kathy Smith's song wasn't destined to become a standard. She lived with Lightfoot for almost 4 years, and at the beginning their relationship had the glow of romance and glamour. But the glow gradually faded, and romance and glamour gave way to jealousy and bitterness. When Kathy and Lightfoot broke up, she worked on a singing career of her own. She was attracted by the sense of family she felt around the musicians, and she found herself increasingly drawn into their way of life. She drank heavily, she used soft drugs, and she sniffed cocaine. By the spring of 1978, almost without realizing where she was headed, she began to slip into a fondness for hard drugs. She was living at the time in a mansion in Hollywood with Keith Richards and other members of the Rolling Stones and their entourage.
The way I look at it, Keith, maybe I'm screwed up and I don't care.
Are we talking heroin here?
What else?
Well, there's nothing like it, is there?
When I really started to get into it, when we were all in Paris and you guys were cutting the album, I used to take the great stuff that Moroccan roadie had. You remember that guy? Anyway, I took his heroin, which was dynamite. And about every 10 minutes seemed like I'd have to run into the can and throw up. But I couldn't not take it, you understand?
Kathy, you're talking to someone who knows, you know. Heroin gets a hold on you.
I couldn't stop because there's no goddamn high in the whole world like a heroin high. And after a while, it got even better because I stopped all the throwing up.
Better watch it, Kathy. It costs. Look at me. I was busted by the cops in Toronto for possession. Had to go through lawyers, courts, and all that other shit. No more.
You got off the charge?
Yeah, more or less.
Yeah, but out here, heroin, coke, they're like part of the party scene. I mean, everybody does drugs. It's a very social thing.
A person like me in this business, I can go anywhere, not just bloody Hollywood. And people will try to lay drugs on me. It's the fans, God bless them. They think they're doing me a favor.
They can do me a favor any day they want. I'm beginning to think I need heroin. And it isn't just to get feeling good. It's to stop feeling bad. You know what I'm talking about?
You're addicted to this stuff.
You think so?
It takes one to know one.
Oh, Jesus. I'm a junkie.
For the following 3 years, Kathy Smith couldn't escape the Hollywood drug life. She scrambled for money, and almost all of it went into supporting her drug habit. In early March of 1982, when a friend invited her to join a party with John Belushi, a party that promised money to buy drugs, Kathy was glad to accept. Belushi had plenty of money. He found his first national fame as one of the resident players on the immensely popular Saturday Night Live show on NBC television.
All right? Now listen, there are 9 different countries where March comes in like a frog and goes out like a golden retriever. That's not the weird part. No, the weird part is...
Belushi's comedy was brash and outrageous, a style that he used in creating the character Bluto in Animal House, a 1978 movie that became the biggest money-making comedy in Hollywood history. Another Belushi film, The Blues Brothers, was also a major success. But after a couple of movies that hadn't attracted much attention at the box office, Belushi was in Hollywood in March 1982 in an effort to get his career back on track. Kathy Smith joined him for the party that started on Monday, March 1st. With changing personnel and at different locations, the party was only beginning to wind down in the early hours of March 5th at the private club on Sunset Boulevard. After Kathy, Belushi, and the third member of their group, Nelson Lyon, had injected themselves with drugs at the club, they drove a few blocks further up Sunset Boulevard to a hotel called the Chateau Marmont. Belushi was registered in Bungalow 3 at the back of the hotel.
Feel rotten. He's saying I'm going to be sick.
Don't do it in here. This place is enough of a mess already.
Don't get on my case. I'm going to camp.
John's been down all night. It's usually a lot of laughs. They're caught up at the party.
What do you expect? The guy's hardly been to bed for like 5 days.
I've never seen anybody do so many drugs.
You think so? You've only been around half the time. Are you all right, John?
Yeah. I ate all this greasy food earlier on, I guess.
I'm wasted, man. I gotta get home to my old lady.
That's so split.
Go out on Sunset and the cab will come by.
Mm. Thanks for the party, John.
Yeah.
You too, Kathy.
You want me to leave?
Shoot me up again. You and me both.
John, you ought to catch some sleep, like seriously.
Kathy, do like I say. I want to hit.
Okay, all right. But afterwards, I'm putting you to bed.
Yeah.
Some for you. Some for me. Not the belt around your arm.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very nice. That's nice.
A person could get used to it.
I need something to make me feel good. And I get so screwed over out here. I'm just your studios, the agents. Everybody's dealing me in the wrong goddamn projects.
I'll tuck you into bed.
Well, now, don't go. Yeah. And I want to talk. I got all these projects, you know, scripts. And none of these movies people want me to make. And they're not worth shit. And I can go down the tubes. I don't feel any respect for the material. Yeah. Well, not since I made the Blues Brothers.
John, we've been talking like 3 hours or something.
Yeah. Well, maybe I'll sleep a while. And turn up the thermostat. Well, yeah, I feel weird. It's like I got a chill.
I'll be out in the living room. Call me if you want anything. Is there some paper around here to write on? What a junk pile. There's got to be a piece of notepaper. Oh, okay, now. Dear Bernie, I'm not too late in writing, huh? So sorry about that. I was considering coming back to Toronto and see what's shaking up there. I sure wished I had the money to lease a store, pay somebody a percentage to run it. Whatever. I must get out of L.A. soon. It's driving me to an early death, what with all my self-abuse. I'm such a sucker for a good time. Ho, ho, ho. Hey, John. You want a glass of water?
Yes. It's just my lungs or something. Hey, don't leave.
Nobody's leaving, John. I'm going to order from room service. You want a coffee?
I just don't want to be alone.
Room service? I'd like one continental breakfast for Bungalow 3. But make the toast whole wheat and send up some strawberry jam. John, you asleep? It's 10 o'clock already. I gotta go out. Yeah. You're asleep. See you later, man.
Hey, John, open the door. It's me, Bill. Come on, it's noon. What the hell? I'll use my own key. John, you in bed or what? Oh, hell. John, get up. We're already late for the meeting.
Hey, wake up.
John? John? Oh, no. You dumb son of a bitch, John. Dumb son of a bitch.
Bill Wallace worked for John Belushi as a physical fitness trainer. When he found his employer collapsed on the bed, he called for assistance. Within a few minutes, the Los Angeles police and a team of paramedics hurried to the Chateau Marmont. They were too late. John Belushi was dead. Lieutenant Randolph Mancini of the Hollywood Division of the L.A. Police Department took charge of the investigation at the hotel, and Dr. Ronald Kornblum, acting medical examiner for the County of Los Angeles, was summoned to examine John Belushi's body.
It's back here in the bedroom, Doctor.
Yeah.
You heard who it is, haven't you?
Yeah, I can see the headlines now.
Looks like he OD'd himself.
Yeah, well, those are fresh needle marks in his arms. I don't see any long history of needle use, though. Maybe he was a novice. Your people turn up any drugs around here?
Well, there was some powder over there in the dresser. Two kinds, we think. Heroin and cocaine.
I can't give you anything definite on cause of death until I do the autopsy. Tomorrow, probably.
Funny thing is, we haven't found any of the paraphernalia for shooting the stuff. No needles, no spoons, just a couple of paper bindles with powder traces on them. And this belt.
Looped to about the size that it fit around this dead man's arm.
Yeah, it's a woman's belt.
What the hell is this? What is it, officer?
This is a one-way street, ma'am, and it isn't your way.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, officer. It's just a habit. Like, we always turn down here because it's a shortcut into the chateau.
Is this car yours?
It's a friend's. He's staying at the chateau.
What's his friend's name?
John Belushi. What's happening?
You mind telling me what that is in the top of the purse there?
Those things aren't mine either. They're, syringe and other stuff.
You want to get out of the car, ma'am, and bring your purse?
Kathy Smith was taken to the Hollywood station of the Los Angeles Police Department, where Richard Iddings, a homicide detective, questioned her. To Kathy's surprise, Detective Iddings was agreeable and sympathetic.
Now, I'm going to tape this conversation, Miss Smith, but I want to make it clear that these are strictly routine questions about what looks like an accidental drug overdose. All right.
What is this all about? I mean, whose drug overdose?
Oh, I'm sorry. John Belushi's. I'm afraid he's dead.
John? Oh, my God, no, not John. He was alive when I left this morning.
Well, let's back up a bit on this. Now, you tell me now, have you been shooting heroin?
I used to. Like, I went through detox last year.
You mind if I look at your arm?
There's a lot of discoloration there.
You seem like fresh needle marks. You sure you haven't been shooting?
Well, I did a few days ago. Tuesday, I shot cocaine.
Okay, I'd like to look in your purse if you have no objections.
And there's a syringe and a needle and a spoon in there that belong to John.
You like to tell me about it?
I didn't want the maid to find them. John was asleep at the chateau, and I was leaving, so I took them. It was just to protect him. He was into shooting cocaine, and these last few days he kept calling me to come over. He'd just gotten into shooting, him and Nelson Lyon. They were new to it, and John, well, he was a good guy, and I took the stuff so he wouldn't get hurt.
You're being very candid, Miss Smith. I tell you what, I'm going to take these things, a syringe and a spoon, and then you won't have to worry.
Worry?
Yeah, about the maid finding them.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. You want to rest in here for a while before you go home. The press is swarming around outside.
That's all you want? I can leave?
Yeah, no problem. Have a good day, Miss Smith.
For once in my life, my God, for once I get a break.
Kathy Smith had lied to Detective Iddings when she denied using heroin. In any case, the Hollywood police did not seem interested in pursuing an investigation into all the circumstances of John Belushi's death. Perhaps they were satisfied that Belushi had died of a self-administered overdose of drugs. Whatever their motivation, the Hollywood police decided there was nothing in the autopsy of Dr. Ronald Kornblum to cause them to change their minds.
Let's see. In the Belushi matter, I placed the time of death at between 10 a.m. and 12 noon on March 5th, 1982. And I determined that the cause of death is the result of acute cocaine and heroin intoxication. I base that on several factors. There are extensive needle marks on both arms, the most recent being within 4 hours or less of the actual time of death. There is cocaine throughout the body, and there is morphine, which is the chemical breakdown of heroin, present in the body's blood and bile.
The police in Los Angeles showed no further interest in Kathy Smith, but the California media pursued her for her version of John Belushi's death. Kathy returned to Toronto to escape the press, but she did not remain altogether silent. In mid-June of 1982, two reporters from Florida, Larry Haley and Tony Brenna, came to Toronto and checked into the Sheraton Hotel. Over the following 10 days, for up to 12 hours a day, Haley and Brenna talked to Kathy Smith in their hotel room about John Belushi's death. The newspaper that employed the two reporters paid Kathy $15,000 for the 10 days of interviews. The newspaper was the National Enquirer.
The material you're giving us is excellent, Kathy, but bear with Larry and me for a few more details, just to confirm.
How's your Courvoisier, Kathy? You happy?
I'm doing okay. Let's finish. This place is making me a little crazy.
All right. You said you were doing drugs with John for the best part of a week.
I hung out with him for most of the whole 5 days he was out there in Hollywood, and any time that he shot anything while I was around, I did it for him.
You said John might have shot himself up, but there was some point where you took over the shooting for him?
Like, it got to the situation where he couldn't even hold the needle up to his arm. He was right out of it. That was part of the reason I handled the shooting.
And when did it end?
3:30 in the morning on the Friday. That's when I shot up John for the last time. You know what I think?
Hmm?
I think John had a death wish.
The National Enquirer is a tabloid weekly with a circulation of 6.5 million in North America. The issue of June 29, 1982, carried a copyright article that purported to tell, in Kathy Smith's own words, the story of John Belushi's last days and of Smith's role in his death.
none of the Inquirer's audience read the issue with more interest than Michael Montagna and Richard J. Christie. Montagna and Christie were deputy district attorneys for the county of Los Angeles.
Have you seen this thing, Dick?
Yeah, are you kidding? Right now it's more popular around the office than Joe Wamba's new book.
I killed John Belushi. I didn't mean to, but I was responsible for his death.
Do you believe it?
I'm sure as hell not going to ignore it.
Yeah, the people over at the Hollywood station let the thing go as a self-administered overdose.
According to this article, the Smith woman did all or most of the injecting.
Hmm. You'd probably get her under the health and safety code. Furnishing and administering a controlled substance and so on and so forth. That's a felony.
I think we can go for more.
What more?
Murder. Penal code defines murder as the unlawful killing of a human being with malice aforethought.
Yeah.
All right? The case law says malice is implied where the death results from an act involving a high degree of probability that it will result in death when the act is done for a base antisocial purpose and with a wanton disregard for life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what the Smith woman did ought to put her in the category of implied malice.
She's already told the Inquirer she stuck the needles in Belushi's arm, and we've got the autopsy report that says Belushi died of too much heroin and cocaine.
No question, Mike. Reopen the investigation.
Deputy District Attorney Michael Montagna put together his case against Kathy Smith and took it before a grand jury in Los Angeles. On March 15, 1983, slightly over a year after John Belushi's death, the Los Angeles grand jury handed down an indictment charging Kathy Smith with 13 counts of administering cocaine and heroin in violation of the Health and Safety Code of California and one count of murder under the California Penal Code. In Toronto, Kathy Smith retained a lawyer. The lawyer was my brother, Brian Greenspan.
Every American newspaper I look at, there's my name in the headlines.
Uh-huh. The L.A. Press is making a witch hunt out of this.
You don't need to tell me who the witch is they're hunting. Kathy Smith, the killer of John Belushi.
Yeah, at least nobody can quote you anymore. Please keep it that way, Kathy. No talking to reporters, all right? And as for the legal side of things, well, just leave that to the people in this office.
I'm charged with murder, which is ridiculous.
Well...
But now what? What happens next?
The United States government, on behalf of the state of California, will go before our courts right here in Toronto, okay? And they'll ask the judge to order you extradited back to Los Angeles for trial on the murder count and the 13 drug counts.
And you're going to fight the extradition?
Of course I am. But I have to warn you, Kathy, I'm fighting with one hand tied behind my back.
Oh, God.
Or maybe it's fighting with a blindfold over my eyes. Anyway, the point is this, Kathy. Now, you see, I don't know exactly what evidence the DA down in Los Angeles put before the grand jury. By law, grand jury proceedings are secret. See? All I know about the case against you is what I've read in a couple of dozen affidavits that the counsel for the United States has filed with the court up here as the basis for his extradition request.
These affidavits, they aren't any good?
Well, they're a second best, as far as we're concerned. The affidavits were sworn by the people who appeared before the grand jury, and they're a kind of précis of what the people told the grand jury. They don't give us the whole story, you see?
Tell me the truth. It looks bad, right?
Every case looks tough at the beginning.
The United States began its extradition proceedings in the middle of June 1983... in the courthouse on University Avenue in Toronto. The presiding judge was Judge Stephen Borens of the District Court of the Judicial District of York. Eric Kumaraswamy, a Canadian federal crown attorney, represented the United States of America.
Your Honor, on behalf of the demanding state, I propose to put in evidence 27 affidavits in support of the request for extradition of the alleged fugitive, Catherine Evelyn Smith. But I understand that my friend has a preliminary objection to these affidavits.
Go ahead, Mr. Greenspan.
Not with respect to all 27 affidavits, Your Honor. A mere 9.
Which 9 are we talking about?
The affidavit of Dr. Ronald Kornblum. That's 1, Your Honor. Dr. Kornblum performed the autopsy on John Belushi, and I submit that his affidavit is equivocal on the cause of Belushi's death. The affidavit of Nelson Lyon is another. Mr. Lyon was present when many of the alleged drug injections took place, and in my view, his affidavit contains misleading statements.
Well, let's suppose you're correct in your submission, Mr. Greenspan. How do you propose to cure the problem?
By cross-examination, Your Honor, the 9 affidavits should not be admitted in evidence against Miss Smith until Your Honor permits me to cross-examine the deponents to the affidavits.
In arguing for the right to cross-examine Dr. Kornblum, Nelson Lyon, and the 7 other deponents on their affidavits, Brian Greenspan was arguing against a long-established practice. In most courtroom proceedings, witnesses give their evidence viva voce, in person and in court, and opposing counsel have the right to cross-examine them on their testimony. But the Canadian Extradition Act provides that in proceedings under it, the foreign state asking for extradition of a fugitive person may introduce evidence by way of affidavits taken in the foreign jurisdiction. In the Kathy Smith proceedings, Brian Greenspan was asking Judge Borens to overturn the established procedure.
Your Honor, I submit that the 1982 Charter of Rights has radically changed the situation we face in extradition proceedings.
The Charter's been raised as a defense in 1 or 2 other extradition proceedings in the past year.
Unsuccessfully, I'm aware of that, Your Honor.
Do you have an argument to distinguish those cases?
I'm relying on Section 7 and 11 of the Charter, Your Honor. Section 7 guarantees that no one will be deprived of his liberty except in accordance with the principles of fundamental justice. And Section 11 says that any person charged with an offense is presumed innocent until he's proven guilty in a fair and public hearing. Now, Your Honor, both these notions, a fair hearing and fundamental justice, demand the right to cross-examine on affidavits in an extradition hearing under the situation that Miss Smith faces.
What do you say to that, Mr. Kumaraswamy?
Yes, well, all we're deciding in this court, Your Honor, is whether the affidavits show there's sufficient evidence to send Miss Smith back to California. A court down there will determine her guilt or innocence. That is the stage in California where Miss Smith's counsel will properly have the chance to cross-examine Dr. Kornblum and these other people.
But if I can't cross-examine now, before extradition, then Miss Smith's charter rights are infringed.
Mr. Greenspan, I don't have much difficulty being persuaded that the right to cross-examine is a principle of fundamental justice.
That's my point, Your Honor.
But another section of the Charter gives me trouble.
You're referring to Section 1.
Exactly. Section 1 tells us that the rights and freedoms set out in Section 7, 11, and all the other sections of the Charter are subject to such reasonable limits as can be demonstrably justified in a free and democratic society. Aren't these proceedings against Miss Smith an instance where Section 1 should be applied?
Well, I submit not, Your Honor.
After all, as Mr. Kumaraswamy pointed out, this court isn't dealing with Miss Smith's guilt or innocence.
The question is this, Your Honor. How far are we going to permit Section 1 to go in infringing Miss Smith's rights under the Charter? When does it stop?
Judge Borens reserved judgment to consider counsel's arguments. When court resumed, he made the following ruling.
I appreciate counsel's submission that there's always a risk that a Canadian citizen might be extradited to face trial in a foreign state on the basis of affidavit evidence which might have been exposed as false by cross-examination. But that situation would be exceedingly rare. I must hold in these proceedings that admitting the affidavits in evidence without cross-examination of the deponents is a reasonable limit on Miss Smith's rights under the Charter.
Brian Greenspan appealed Judge Boren's decision on this fundamental constitutional question to the Supreme Court of Ontario and then to the Ontario Court of Appeal. The appeal process stretched over several months, and while it proceeded, the actual extradition hearing before Judge Boren's was adjourned. During the same period, Brian Greenspan was carrying on a series of friendly telephone discussions with Michael Montagna, the Los Angeles Assistant District Attorney who had charge of Kathy Smith's case in California. Greenspan was looking for a plea negotiation. He believed in the correctness of his arguments in court on behalf of Kathy Smith, but he faced the very real probability that she would eventually be extradited to California. He was seeking to ensure that she would be sent there under the best possible circumstances. Late in 1983, he flew to California, and on December the 28th, he met in the Los Angeles District Attorney's office with Michael Montagna.
What I'm telling you, Mike, is how you can get Kathy back to California.
The sooner the better. You wouldn't believe the pressure down here, all kinds of press and other people asking what's taking so long to put this woman on trial. Mm-hmm. It's already almost a year since the grand jury's indictment.
Yeah, but I'm not going to send her back on a murder charge.
We put together a lot of evidence against her, Brian.
Well, I'm prepared to concede from what I've read in the affidavits that you've got prima facie evidence for a criminal charge.
But
it is not a murder charge.
Well, I go this far, Brian. I've never taken the position she killed Belushi intentionally.
Well, that gives us plenty of room to move around. Now, what about scaling the charge down from murder?
How far down?
Involuntary manslaughter. From what I know of your evidence, the facts may constitute a charge of involuntary manslaughter.
Will she come back and plead guilty to that in our court?
Mike, I'm only Kathy's Canadian extradition counsel. I can't tell you how she'll plead.
Yeah, I appreciate that. She'll have a local attorney acting for her down here. It's his decision at that point.
That's right. Now, I'll go this far. If you switch the charge to involuntary manslaughter, the odds are you'll never see a trial.
You think she'll plead?
Well, I'm only talking about the odds.
How about the 13 drug counts?
13 is much too much.
Would you accept 3?
If you're offering 3, we might accept 3.
All right. You realize if she comes back and pleads to one charge of involuntary manslaughter and 3 drug counts, she could do 2-3 years in prison.
Or she could do no time, depending on how the judge feels and on what Kathy's attorney says, and on a few other things.
Here's what I'll do. I'll send up a new requisition for extradition to the people in Toronto. I'll drop the murder and the 13 drug charges and change it to involuntary manslaughter and 3 counts of administering drugs.
And I'll recommend to Kathy that she return voluntarily to California.
That takes a lot of heat off of my office. But look, there's one thing.
Which is?
Before this arrangement goes through, I need approval from upstairs, from my district attorney.
But you're recommending the deal.
Brian, my strongest recommendation.
Brian Greenspan returned home with an excellent deal for his client. Instead of facing a murder trial and a possible life term in prison, Kathy Smith had a choice of pleading guilty to a less serious charge with a chance of no prison time. But over the following several weeks, Michael Montagna was unable to confirm the deal. Brian Greenspan was caught in a dilemma. Without final approval of the arrangement he'd arrived at with Montagna, he had to continue the fight against Kathy Smith's extradition. His appeal on Judge Boren's refusal to allow cross-examination on the 9 affidavits was turned down by the Ontario Supreme Court and then by the Court of Appeal. It was late March of 1984. Greenspan applied for leave to appeal to the Supreme Court of Canada on the affidavit question. 2 days before the application was scheduled to be heard in Ottawa, Michael Montagna telephoned from Los Angeles.
Brian, this call is one of those good news, bad news things.
Mike, I've been waiting 4 months for confirmation of our arrangement. That's about all the bad news I can stand.
The trouble is my DA down here, Bob Philobosian. I can't get approval on the change in charges on him.
What's his objection?
If you ask me, it's politics. Philobosian's coming up for re-election in June. And no DA can appear to be going soft on a drug case. At election time, anyway. Especially a case that's as high a profile as this one.
So give me the good news.
The man Philobosian's running against, a guy named Ira Reiner. I know I can get the okay on our arrangement from him.
What are Reiner's chances of beating Philobosian?
They're pretty strong. But this gets us back into the bad news area. You see, even if Reiner wins, he doesn't take office for 6 months. Philobosian stays on the job until January 1st of 85.
Well, that shouldn't be a problem. Philobosian'd be a lame duck DA. Why should he care what the voters think after they voted him out?
You don't know the man. Small C conservative Republican. And a person like Kathy Smith, she's the opposite of everything he stands for.
I get you.
See, no matter what, I can't see Philobosian approving the deal.
Leaves us waiting on this potentially new DA. What's his name? Reiner.
Can you keep the case before the courts until January? Then if Reiner gets in, we close the deal on the involuntary manslaughter and you send Smith back here.
I've got at least another year of arguments and appeals, as long as you don't oppose her continuing to remain on bail.
You're going to need that time. But we're going to have to continue formally opposing the bail. However, the opposition won't be strenuous.
And what if Philobosian gets back into office?
Forget it, Brian. I've given you enough bad news for one call.
The Supreme Court of Canada turned down Greenspan's application for leave to appeal Judge Boren's ruling on the affidavit evidence, and the extradition hearing was set to resume before Judge Boren's in August of 1984. In June, Ira Reiner was elected District Attorney of Los Angeles. Robert Philobosian would remain in office until January 1985. and he continued to refuse to approve the arrangements that Michael Montagna and Brian Greenspan had arrived at. As if Greenspan didn't have enough complications to deal with, the journalist Bob Woodward gave him one more.
You're in print again, Kathy.
Well, we knew it was coming. The Watergate guy's book.
Book? You were supposed to be interviewed for a series of articles, not for a national bestseller. Wired, The Short Life and Fast Times of John Belushi by Bob Woodward. We got a very fat book here, Kathy.
I thought it was going to be an article in my favor. I mean, he's got a very straight reputation, the guy who wrote the book that nailed Richard Nixon.
Yeah. Well, here's what Woodward says happened when you were alone with Belushi at 3 o'clock, 3:30, on the morning he died. Yeah. John produced a little more coke from his pocket. Smith mixed it with some heroin for a speedball. She gave herself the first shot and then made one for John that had a tenth each of cocaine and heroin.
That's not good, eh?
Not really, Kathy. But I'm going to try something. Your Honor, I propose to enter as an exhibit a work ostensibly of nonfiction entitled Wired by Robert Woodward.
Yes, I'm aware of the book.
My argument is that passages in this book allege that Miss Smith is guilty of the very acts that the state of California has accused her of committing. Your Honor, Wired is a national bestseller in the United States, and the immense publicity its allegations have received make it impossible for Miss Smith to have a fair and impartial trial.
Well, isn't the trial court in California in a better position to make a decision about the book's impact on an impartial trial?
It has equal validity at this stage, Your Honor. My submission is that the book has undermined the principles of fundamental justice by announcing to all of North America a verdict of guilty on the matters that are just now coming before Your Honor to decide. The only remedy is for you to quash the warrant for Miss Smith's extradition.
Well, Mr. Greenspan, as I read the present law of extradition, it's for the California court ultimately to decide whether the book has taken away Miss Smith's chances of a fair trial. I must hold against your motion to quash the extradition warrant.
With Judge Bourne's ruling, Ari Kumaraswamy at last began an outline of the United States government's case against Kathy Smith. Mr. Kumaraswamy suggested to the court that the affidavit evidence led to an inescapable conclusion.
Your Honor, we have Miss Smith's admission to the National Enquirer reporters that Mr. Belushi received some 24 injections of drugs in the last 30 hours of his life, and that she was responsible for administering most or many of the injections. We have evidence that she was alone with Mr. Belushi in the last hours of his life. We have Dr. Kornblum's report that Mr. Belushi died of drug injections that were administered in the hours shortly before his death. Your Honor, I suggest it is open to a California jury to find that Miss Smith is guilty under California law of Mr. Belushi's murder. And I submit that is sufficient for you to order her extradition.
Brian Greenspan spent little of the court's time in disputing Mr. Kumaraswamy's interpretation of the affidavit evidence. Instead, he presented an argument to Judge Bourne's based on the comparison of the definitions of murder under the California Penal Code and the Canadian Criminal Code. In California, the act which Kathy Smith was alleged to have committed, that is, administering drugs in a reckless manner, fell into a category of murder. But such an act would not be considered murder in Canada unless Kathy Smith meant to cause John Belushi's death or meant to cause him bodily harm that she knew was likely to cause his death. Brian Greenspan argued that since she had no such intention, her act did not constitute murder under the Canadian Criminal Code.
The point I'm leading to, Your Honor, is that if it's murder in California, but it isn't murder in Canada, then the Extradition Act does not apply.
I think you're putting an interpretation on the act that may be too strict, Mr. Greenspan.
I'd argue it this way, Your Honor. If the offense charged in California is murder, and if the acts that Miss Smith is alleged to have committed amount to a prima facie case of murder under our code, then the Extradition Act can be invoked. Otherwise, it has no application.
I take it that the key element to your argument is intent.
Well, it wouldn't be murder under our code unless Miss Smith intended to kill Belushi when she injected him or intended to harm him.
I agree with you up to a certain limit. As I read the affidavits that Mr. Kumaraswamy has filed, I don't see any evidence from which a jury could decide that Miss Smith intended to kill or harm Mr. Belushi. But there's another point you haven't addressed, Mr. Greenspan.
Your Honor?
I think on the facts alleged against Miss Smith, a prima facie case of manslaughter could be made out against her under our criminal code.
I can't dispute that, Your Honor.
Well, so that at least we've got murder under the California Penal Code, and we've got a prima facie case of manslaughter under the Canadian Criminal Code.
But I'd argue, Your Honor, that it must be murder under both codes before the Extradition Act comes into effect.
I think you're making an interpretation of the Act that's too narrow, Mr. Greenspan. It's enough, as I see it, that the conduct alleged against Miss Smith would constitute any criminal offense under Canadian law. You and I have agreed that her acts would amount to a prima facie case of manslaughter in Canada. That, in my view, satisfies the requirements of the Extradition Act.
The circumstances may well have satisfied the requirements of the Extradition Act. The larger question, though, is whether any fair-minded Canadian would be satisfied with a situation in which a citizen could be extradited for murder on facts that everyone agreed could never amount to murder in this country. Brian Greenspan appealed the decision to the Supreme Court of Ontario. The appeal was dismissed. Greenspan went the next step and appealed to the Ontario Court of Appeal. That hearing was scheduled for the last week in January 1985. A few days before he was to go to the Court of Appeal, however, Brian Greenspan received another telephone call from Michael Montagna.
Brian, the deal's on. Tell Smith to pack her bags.
Wait a minute. Are you saying the new DA's given his okay on the terms you and I have been talking about for the last year?
Ira Reiner, yeah, right. He's in favor, absolutely. The only thing Ira insists on is we announce the deal from down here. We're the guys who go public first.
Mike, Kathy will want reassurance she's going back on involuntary manslaughter and 3 drug counts.
Tell her sure, of course. That's the condition we accept. Who's going to represent Smith when she gets down here?
Well, I think you might know the man I've retained. Howard Weitzman?
Know him? Are you kidding? You blew us out of the water on the DeLorean prosecution.
All right. Now, if you want to make the announcement on our deal first, that's fine with me, Mike. But the timing is important. I don't want Kathy to spend any time in jail up here before your people take her back to Los Angeles.
No sweat on that. We announced down here your woman's on the plane for L.A. the same night.
Okay. I think the whole thing's locked in.
Nice doing business with you, Brian.
Betty, ask Kathy to come in.
It's all over.
Well, the part up here is over. The part in Los Angeles is just starting.
What about this guy Weitzman? He's good.
Everybody knows about him these days because he's the one that got an acquittal for John DeLorean in a high-profile drug case.
Oh.
Now, but the reason DeLorean hired him in the first place, Kathy, was because Howard already had a reputation as a fantastic defense attorney.
So I'm going back?
You fly back next Monday evening.
The last time I was in L.A., I was a junkie and free. Now I'm clean and maybe I'm going to jail.
On January the 22nd, 1985, Kathy Smith appeared with her California attorney, Howard Weitzman, before Superior Court Judge Robert Devich in Los Angeles. As soon as Kathy Smith had personally entered the jurisdiction of the California courts, something significant to her defense took place. By California law, the grand jury proceedings, which had been secret up until that point, now became available to Kathy Smith's lawyers for the first time. Howard Weitzman spent several days reading a transcript of the proceedings. When he finished, he telephoned Brian Greenspan.
Brian, I've got no choice. I'm going to back out of the deal you made with Montana.
Wait a minute, Howard. Back up and tell me what you're talking about.
We don't need to go for involuntary manslaughter. Let him put Kathy on trial for murder. I can beat it.
What do you know that I don't?
That's the whole point. I know plenty that you didn't know when you were doing the extradition. It's all in the grand jury proceedings.
Yeah, like what? Give me a taste.
Listen to this. The guy who did the autopsy, Kornblum,
yeah.
He's testifying. Question. Dr. Kornblum, did the 330 injection cause death? Answer, no. How do you like that, Brian?
Kathy hasn't admitted she gave Belushi any injections after 3:30.
Right. There's no evidence she had anything to do with the drugs from 3:30 until she left around 10 that morning.
You see, that admission of Kornblum's, that's the kind of thing I would have found out if the courts up here had allowed me to cross-examine on the affidavits.
Sure, and there's even a small hint in here that maybe somebody else, a third person, might have gone to Belushi's bungalow after Kathy left.
That is strong stuff.
So, what's your position on this?
You do what's in Kathy's best interests.
I thought you'd see it that way.
Now, if you want to repudiate the deal I made with Mike Montana, you go right ahead. The deal was made on the basis of what I knew, and the assumption that what I knew was factually accurate, and it isn't.
Brian, I'm getting into my well-known fighting stance.
How's Kathy taking all of this?
Patiently.
Well, that's something she's learned a lot about these last 3 years.
In the light of these developments, had Judge Borns decided to allow cross-examination on the affidavit evidence, it is my view that Kathy Smith would never have been extradited to California on either murder or manslaughter. The law is wrong, and this case shows the need for fundamental legislative change by Parliament. Weitzman backed out of the arrangement. Montagna reinstated the original murder count and the 13 counts of administering drugs. The stage seemed set for a dramatic trial that would inevitably attract intense media and public attention. But that trial lay many months away, perhaps as much as a year. Kathy Smith, on bail in Hollywood, appeared to have found a very different life. She lived quietly with a friend, she found a job, and she avoided her old acquaintances.
After John Belushi's death, my life changed completely, both for better and for worse. The best part is I've discovered what life is like without drugs, and I like it. The worst part is not knowing what will happen to me. The prospect of prison frightens me, and I wonder how I'd survive. I've broken my heroin habit for good, and that counts for something. It took John's death to shake me awake. But I dearly wish that both of us had done it differently.
You have heard the true story of the extradition of Kathy Smith, an episode in our series, The Scales of Justice, recreating real events in Canadian crime. The script was by Jack Batten, and the commentary by the Toronto lawyer, Edward L. Greenspan, QC. In the cast, you have heard Chappelle Jaffe as Kathy Smith, Saul Rubinek as her lawyer Brian Greenspan, and Neil Monroe in the role of John Belushi. George Busa was heard as Levon Helm, Booth Savage as Gordon Lightfoot, and Roy Crost as Keith Richards. You have also heard John Bayliss, Alan Fawcett, Jim Henshaw, Michael Kirby, Paul Kligman, Sean McCann, James Morris, Michael J. Reynolds, Angela Rizakos, Chuck Shimata, Paul Soles, and John Stalker, with Ray Stancer as District Court Judge Stephen Borins. Technical operations were by Derek Stubbs, with sound effects by Stephanie McKenna. The production assistant was Nancy McElveen. The music consultant was Stephanie McKenna. And the live guitar accompaniment was by Paul Mills. Casting director, Ann Weldon Tate, with the assistance of Catherine Kester. The associate producer is Guy Gavriel Kay. The Scales of Justice is produced in Toronto by George Jonas. This is Fred Napoli speaking. Next week, listen to author-lawyer William Devereaux's dramatization of a homosexual thrill killing in Vancouver, The Trial of John Wirtz on The Scales of Justice.